Mayflowers starting to bloom, leaves exploding from branches, and it's time for another springtime edition of Spectrum West. Hi, everybody. I'm Al Ross. This week, we're featuring some in-depth conversations with some interesting folks who have important things to tell us. Greg Gilbertson is here for a look at his new CD called Surviving the Echoes. We'll find out what those echoes are and hopefully how to survive them, and we'll hear a few samples from the disc. The Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra concludes another impressive season Saturday evening, after which it prepares for its first in a new venue. Music director Nobuyoshi, or Nobu Yasuda, welcomed me to his UW Eau Claire Music Department office for a conversation about all that's on their plates. Jim Oliver features a one-woman show coming to the Festival Theater Black Box Theater in St. Croix Falls, within a conversation with the one woman, Rachel Coonley. It's a fictional interpretation of one of America's true tragedies of the last 20 years. And here is where we jump in this week. When it's the 26th of anything, that's tough to pull off, but benefits so many. You can probably conclude they've got it down and it works. That describes the 26th annual Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive. Stamp being the clue that it's coordinated by the letter carriers of the U.S. Postal Service. You may have already received your bags, and come Saturday, those bags filled with non-perishable food items will be collected all over America. Union President Corey Grotti does the talking for the Eau Claire effort. U.S. Postal Service. You guys get beat up a bit every once in a while, and like the latest rant against Amazon, you were the ping pong ball being volleyed over the net. So how long have you been with the service?
I've been with the U.S. Postal Service for 19 years.
With the things that people are saying about the Postal Service, how is it within the building? Good morale? Everybody's happy? Or how's it going?
Yeah, postal employees in general, we're a tight-knit family. The work is stressful. Yeah. Everybody sees us out on the street walking around on a sunny day. It's not all about that. We have time constraints. We have places to be at certain times.
Yes.
And mail to get delivered.
And it's still a good job.
It's a very enjoyable job.
Good. I wanted to hear that from somebody who does it. Because, you know, you hear it and you just don't know whether it's the truth. I mean, hard work and persistence. What's that line about the rain and sleet and stuff?
Rain nor sleet, no gloom of night will keep me from my appointed rounds.
See? And that's the Postal Service will just keep going because you guys do it no matter what.
So. We do it, and we do it well. We are the only company in America that delivers to every household in every community, yep, including all the rural areas, mm-hmm, 6 days a week. And now we're doing packages in some areas 7 days a week.
You know, and I know the letter carriers were always a big part of Jerry Lewis's MDA thing, and raising big amounts of cash.
We were the first national sponsor of the Muscular Dystrophy Association.
And so helping out isn't new to the men and women of the National Association of Letter Carriers, which is the union, right?
That is correct.
So the history of the Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive, 26 years, that's impressive. Do you have any idea how it started?
It started off as letter carriers being in the community.
Okay.
And we noticed, okay, the food shelves are getting low. Kids are getting out of school. Mm-hmm, it's right about the time that the kids are out of school. Food pantries were getting low. So, hey, that second Saturday in May, let's see if we can help out the food pantries in our own communities and collect some food.
So is this nationwide?
This is nationwide. Largest one-day national food drive. Every community, one day. Saturday, May 12th this year.
So now I'm just being the curious guy I am. Is it mandatory?
No.
It's not mandatory for each area to do it.
And that's where the community comes together with the letter carriers. We ask for volunteers. Contact the Postal Service, your letter carrier, United Way, Feed My People, and St. Francis Food Pantry. We're all looking for volunteers to make this big one-day food drive a success.
And it usually is.
And just last year here in the Chippewa Valley, we collected 155,000 pounds.
Yikes. If I was quick, I could divide that and come up with tons, but I'm not going to.
No.
So I'm thinking that there must be some impressive logistical details to pulling this off. And first, I'm sure you want to give your own shout-out to the carriers themselves, because I'm curious how do they do it. I'm thinking where I live in the boonies, you know, people deliver my mail in a car. And if they have a car that's full of already stuff to put in mailboxes, how do they take the stuff?
We put in the extra effort because it is something we do from our hearts. Mm-hmm. The beginning part of the day is a little rougher than the end part. Like you said, our trucks are already full.
Yeah.
And this is where our volunteers come into play. You know, they'll meet us out on the route. They'll help empty some of the food we have, take it to drop points for us. Some of them will walk with us with their wagons. You know, we have family, friends, or different groups. Mm. Other unions will chip in and help. It's the whole community coming together. It makes you feel warm inside.
But there's got to be a lot. Yeah, well, I can see that. I even feel warm talking to you about it. But the coordination of it all. So you have people who go out. What did they do? Get a phone call and say, my car's full, my truck's full, you got to come and see
they
me?
They can. And certain volunteers we have assigned to certain areas of town. Drive around, find these carriers, pick them up, bring the food back, let them continue on their way. It works out great. And, you know, over the course of years, we've been getting better and better and more volunteers.
Okay, we're with Corey Grotti, a U.S. Postal Service guy. 26th annual Stamp Out Hunger food drive. It is this Saturday. It's the 12th. And everybody knows when they get, is it a green bag?
You know, I'm not sure of the color. It's always blue, green.
Yeah. You get it delivered, and then you can do the thing. The logistics, we've covered that. Tell people who maybe they got a bag in the past and they didn't read the bag. They thought it blew against their mailbox. What happens is your people deliver a bag when?
It's going to be Thursday or Friday they will receive a bag. Of course, you know, you're not limited to only that one bag. Of course, you don't have to fill up the bag. Give what you can. And if, you know, a monetary donation is more your thing, make out a check right to the pantry.
Check should be made out to who, officially?
Yeah, you can make it out to St. Francis Food Pantry or Feed My People. You can make it out to the postmaster. We'll get it to the food pantries that way also. The food pantries with monetary donations, their buying power is significant. Mm-hmm. You know, it's 1 to 10. So if you donate $10, they can buy 100 pounds of food.
And we have a public service announcement running that literally talks about, I think it's 120 different places to which Feed My People distributes in like 20 counties or something. It's huge. Yeah, they do good work. And so your stuff goes right to them. Or St. Francis.
Or St. Francis. Or if you're in, you know, Chippewa Falls, everything's going to go to the Red Cross in that area. Bloomer has their own. Colfax. So whatever community that you're donating in is, it's going to stay within that community. So you're actually helping your friends, your neighbors, sometimes family members.
Uh-huh. So we got the details out about the bag. It's going to be delivered Thursday or Friday. You don't have to just use that one bag if you have a lot of stuff. You put the bags out there and or a check.
And or a check.
Non-perishable food items, obviously.
Non-perishable food items. Please watch expiration dates.
Yes.
You know, we have volunteers that got to sort them anyway, and they're not going to give away expired food also. And another thing is, if you can, try to avoid glass. You know, we're dealing with tons and tons of food here. You know, we talked about that, over 155,000 last year. And a glass jar of spaghetti sauce on the bottom of everything else, it could be a safety hazard. And
I bet you that happens, doesn't it? The letter carrier vehicle smells like pizza sauce.
Exactly.
Well, Corey, thanks to everybody involved. It's not an easy task pulling this off. It means a lot of extra hard work for you guys. On behalf of all of society, I have to say we appreciate your effort. Anything else you want to get in?
No, just thank you for your time. Thank you for everything that you guys do in Wisconsin Public Radio.
And be sure to watch for the bag. By the way, it's blue. I got mine Wednesday, so, you know, if somebody else in the family brought in the mail and just set a bag down, it's blue. So look for a blue plastic bag. Fill it or fill out a check made out to the food bank where you live or the postmaster, and they'll be sure it gets where it needs to go. It's a big day. Coming up, new music from Greg Gilbertson, final concert of the season music from the Symphony, plus Jim Oliver and guest are waiting off stage. Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, where an average of 97% of graduates go on to employment, further schooling, or volunteer service within 8 months. Information at luther.edu. Support also comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona, presenting Mary Solberg Water Portraits, an exhibition of mixed media paintings by Minneapolis artist Mary Solberg, through May 20th, mmam.org. Spectrum West on WPR. as he is 99% of the time. We have to give him a break once in a while. Jim Oliver joins the program right now, and the spotlight of his report shines on St. Croix Falls.
On October 2nd, 2006, a shooting occurred at the West Nickel Mine School, an Amish one-room schoolhouse in the Old Order Amish community of Nickel Mines, a village in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. The gunman, Charles Carl Roberts, took hostages and shot 8 out of 10 girls aged 6 to 13, killing 5, before committing suicide in the schoolhouse. The emphasis on forgiveness and reconciliation in the Amish community's response was widely discussed in the national media. The West Nickel Mine School was torn down, and a new one-room schoolhouse, the New Hope School, was built at another location. The tragic incident inspired a fictional version of the story, written by actress and playwright Jessica Dickey. It's entitled The Amish Project. The Festival Theater of St. Croix Falls will present the one-woman show May the 17th through the 20th in the Franklin Square Black Box Theater. Joining us to talk about the show is the woman who plays 7 characters during the show. She is Rachel Coonley, whose day job is arts education director at the Festival Theater. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Explain how a story about this actual event can be described as fictional.
Oh, that's a great question. Actor and playwright Jessica Dickey, I've been listening to some interviews and researching her. She said when the event occurred, it really touched her and moved her in a way that I think many of us were similarly moved by that story. And she was inspired to create a play, but because it is a news event and because it's such a sensitive news event, she decided to pursue it in a fictionalized way. So there are similarities in the one-person show to the factual events of what happened, but she's very careful not to cross a line that would be exploitative or inappropriate. And it's something I personally think she did very well. I'd read a different review that was kind of looking at the play and wanting more of those factual details, but the way that she pursues the topic in a fictionalized way is so much more respectful, I feel.
So it's not exploitive is a good word. It's not sensationalizing what is a tragic story, I guess is what I'm getting out of that.
Yeah, I think she's very careful not to sensationalize.
Uh-huh. In the show, how has the story changed a little bit, and talk a little bit about who all of these characters are that you portray?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know how familiar you are, Jim, or your listeners are to one-person shows. There's a lot of different ways that they can be structured. This one is structured, I think the best way to describe it is it's kind of like a mosaic, you know, or like another sort of piece of visual art. It's sort of like there is a linear timetable, but the way Jessica Dickey wrote it, one performer jumps around to these 7 distinct characters that have very different perspectives on the day. 2 of the characters are young Amish girls who represent the little girls who were victims on that day, a 14-year-old and a 6-year-old who are sisters. Another character is the fictionalized wife of the gunman. In this script, her name is Carol. Another perspective is a biracial girl named America, whose mother's Puerto Rican and is a recent immigrant to the United States. And America works at a grocery store. The gunman's widow, Carol, patronizes. And she has a completely different perspective on the events that she kind of gets to share, and that we jump back and forth between the different storylines. One of the characters is also a fictionalized version of the gunman, and there's a few different points in the script where the way Jessica Dickey wrote it, the performer switches characters in one line of dialogue. So you have basically 4 different characters saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And on the script, it's the most intimidating-looking thing I've ever seen. So intimidating.
Hmm.
But yeah, so it's been really interesting. And all these different perspectives kind of culminate in what is about a 60 to 65 minute, really a contemplation on the themes of forgiveness and how communities deal with these sort of tragedies and how to move forward from that.
She is Rachel Coonley, who is the actress in the one-woman show, The Amish Project, at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. Well, I'm not sure which direction to go here with this. The process of developing characters in one-person shows has always intrigued me, because how do you, as the actress, keep things straight from one person to another?
I mean, there's a lot that goes into it that aids that. For one, the script. I've spent a month and a half before our rehearsal process even began memorizing far, far more work than I typically need to put into memorizing a script, partly because it's 48 pages of just me, but also because it is seven different characters and seven different perspectives. And sometimes the way the speeches are ordered and the way they relate to each other makes sense intuitively. And sometimes I'm still working to find the connection between the different speeches. But so the script does help. The different perspectives, the way characters' voices are written, are often very different, whether someone speaks in short, clipped sentences or whether someone speaks in long, long, rambling sentences is a way to kind of aid in keeping everyone straight. And then otherwise, I use my actor tools of, you know, making specific choices about who I see these characters as, how I hear their voices, mimicking that with my instrument of my voice and my body, finding very distinct physicalities. For example, the character of Carol, it's sort of suggested through the script that she's a smoker. So if I'm able to, you know, mime having a cigarette and relate to that, that just does something to my body. It informs so much how that character holds herself. And there's another character named Sherry, who's an older character, more close-minded than some of the other characters. And so knowing those details about her opens up, kind of inspires different choices in how I might speak her lines, what resonators I might use, how I might articulate with my voice, and then also how I hold my body. How does Sherry move about the stage, and how is that different than a character like Carol or like America? Some of them are more easy. The youngest Amish girl is so familiar, partly maybe because I do work in arts education and I spend a lot of time with six-year-olds. And then some of the other characters feel very far away from me, like the fictionalized gunman's character, Eddie, is a perspective that feels far away from me. You know, part of what the script is about is how that perspective feels so far away. I also have a wonderful director, my husband, who also is a staff member here at Festival Theater. He's our marketing director. He kind of encouraged me to pursue this show as a one-person show. He had actually seen it at another theater. So he's kind of bringing his, you know, imagination to the table and giving me much-needed feedback as to, like, which characters are clear and distinct and which characters are a little too alike.
Much of the public attention to this event at the time was centered around the forgiveness and reconciliation of the Amish community. How is that depicted in the show?
Well, there's a character that plays an important role in the script that I actually don't portray. The character's name is Aaron. He's an Amish man who is the father of the two Amish girls that I do portray. He is spoken of often throughout the script. He's a close friend with one of the characters I play, and then he and other Amish families meet with the gunman's widow, Carol, shortly after the event, as she is in mourning for her husband. The character of Aaron is kind of an embodiment of forgiveness. On one hand, to the character of Carol, he represents, like, everything good and bad about her struggle with her beliefs with God. And she feels very intensely both the good and both the bad. And he kind of, to her, is like an angel. But then from another perspective, another character sees him in a moment of privacy where he unexpectedly breaks down sobbing, because to one character, he's like this perfect angel, you know, but to another that sees him in a private moment, he is a man who is suffering. So I think the topic of forgiveness is explored in a multifaceted way. Even those of us who make a point to practice forgiveness, it is a practice, and we all have something more to learn. You can think you know what it means to forgive, or you think you can know what it means to, you know, like, sacrifice. Every time I work on this script, I'm like, oh, I know nothing, you know?
A little bit about the technical aspect of the show. Is done in the black box, done in the round, or how is it staged?
It's going to be staged in a proscenium seating, so the audience will be on one side of the space, and I will be on the other.
Mm-hmm. One act, two acts?
A fast one act. It'll be probably between 60 and 70 minutes. It's kind of a nonstop, a lot of me up there.
So there's no time for you to run off and check your lines before you have to go back
in. No, and similarly, I'm not aided by any costume changes. It calls in the script for the performer to be dressed in traditional Amish garb.
Uh-huh. Well, we've been talking to Rachel Kunle, actress in the one-woman show at the Festival Theater, The Amish Project. The show runs May 17th through the 20th in the Franklin Square Black Box Theater in St. Croix Falls. Rachel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
The website, by the way, is festivaltheater.com. That's with an R-E at the end, .org, festivaltheater.org. You'll hear about Greg Gilbertson's new CD a bit later on Spectrum West, but another entity very good at making very good music is the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. Saturday evening, the symphony completes its 2017-2018 season at Gantner Concert Hall on the UW Eau Claire campus. It features the work of three composers, Edward Elgar, and the composing-arranging combination, albeit not prearranged, of Mussorgsky and Ravel. Nobu Yasuda is music director of the symphony, and we visited in his university office. Elgar's Enigma Variations, it's listed as one of his best-known works.
This is by far his probably the best-known piece, except Pomp and Circumstance. This actually music is composed by Elgar when he was actually just kind of taking a break after his violin lessons. So then he was doodling on the piano and then making some melodies and then tried to entertain his wife. And he started playing and then also improvise. It's kind of called the variations. He had a lot of friends, you know. So then he started, you know, improvise, you know, this theme, very famous theme of the, you know, Enigma Variations. So then with the character of those friends. Initially, when he actually published this music, he did not tell anybody, you know, which friends are represented. So that became an enigma.
Okay, I was going to ask, because the word enigma means it's a problem or it's a conundrum. So I wondered, what's perplexing about this piece? The quote that I read, the piece was dedicated to, quote, my friends pictured within. From what I read about him, he was a self-taught composer. To an educated guy like you, does that seem rather amazing?
Actually, I'm a self-taught conductor, too.
So that's not so amazing.
Many things, you know, you develop, you know, sometimes actually you have to do it. But of course, at the same time, I have been trained as a violinist for a long time. So then I played in the orchestra, I played the chamber music, and I have actually observed lots of conductors. So then I, you know, kind of knew what I had to do. However, I don't have any degree in conducting or anything. Just basically, I started studying conducting, and then I just became my dream. And then became basically, I got a job here in Eau Claire. Somehow they offered me a job, and so then I started conducting. Elgar's actually kind of a background as a violinist and also violin teacher. I'm sure he played in ensemble and orchestras, right? That gave him a lot of basic kind of a fundamental thing.
So now you brought up something that I have to go off on a tangent with, and that is conducting. Now, you said you're self-taught. There is a degree in conducting.
Yeah, I mean, usually you have to go to conservatory or school music, music department, you know, so then you study conducting and then other courses like a school study and everything. However, though, if you think about the history of conducting, I mean, especially in a European country, they never really had to take any classes. Usually, you know, those conductors worked as an opera coach. So many conductors at the time was a pianist, and they worked at the opera house, you know, as an opera coach, means that, you know, during the rehearsal, they don't have an orchestra. Mm-hmm. So then the opera coach, you know, had to accompany. Sure, sure. But that's how they learned score and music and also eventually conducting.
Young athletes look at professional athletes and college athletes and what they do and how they do it, and they emulate it. Does that happen to a young person who watches conductors? Do you come up with things that they do and you say, that's pretty cool, I'm going to try to do that?
Yeah, actually, you know, kids really has an incredible imagination, right? I think, you know, from too much information, actually kind of limit your kind of possibilities. So then what I say is that, of course, education is important. You know, maybe you learn how to do stuff more efficiently, but you don't want to lose your kind of imagination and also your free thinking.
Your individuality.
Individuality, of course, and also I want you to try many things. Okay, so that this textbook says you're not supposed to do this, but when you try something, actually, it might work. You know, my conducting, actually, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know what I'm doing and I'm physically, but I know exactly what I try to achieve because I hear music and I try to convey my idea, musical idea with the musicians, and I try to communicate. So I hear what they do, and I react also what they do, and I send them another message. So, I mean, you cannot really prepare these things. Just it's more spontaneous, actually. Yes. It's like, you know, you're taking a walk. The conductor is actually, okay, this is your pacing. Yes, okay, start walking, and then you just enjoy, you know, your walk. Just you find something, or you find some beautiful flower here, or you just stop. And then, yeah, I have to give some kind of a moment to enjoy.
Now, you brought up Elgar's marches. He wrote actually six marches called the Pomp and Circumstance Marches. A portion of March number 1 in D is something that if your grades were good enough, you have heard on graduation day. So that's just a little bit of trivia there on Elgar. I knew that name from something, but we are not playing that. I just want to impress people that I did my research. We're talking with Nobu. He's the music director, conductor, Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. The final concert of the season is Saturday night, Gantner Hall. Elgar and Mussorgsky Ravel is the name of the concert. Pictures at an Exhibition. Now, I read that it was originally written by Mussorgsky as a piano piece, and then Ravel arranged it for orchestra. They were buddies.
Nope.
They weren't.
What do you mean? No.
I thought they were buddies.
Okay, I can explain. You know, I
you need to know. Yeah.
Right. The thing is, I already explained about the Elgar's connection with the variations, right?
Okay.
So he wrote, you know, music about his friends. Right? So Mussorgsky and Ravel, they were not buddies. However, Mussorgsky wrote basically with the inspiration of his friend. He was a painter and designer who actually passed away. So then this painter's actually friend organized the exhibition. So then Mussorgsky actually went to, you know, this exhibition, and he was, you know, looking at those pictures, and he basically, you know, composed the music with that kind of inspiration from each picture.
I can imagine the way things are today. I can't imagine how they were back then. What happens when a guy like Ravel takes Mussorgsky's piece and decides to arrange it for orchestra?
Actually, you know, now everything became business, right? So copyright is a very strict kind of law. But Beethoven, actually, you know, he wrote like lots of kind of variation on the theme of Mozart. I mean, I don't think Beethoven asked Mozart, can I use your melody? I don't think so. Then, I mean, the same thing happened. Actually, this Mussorgsky's, particularly this picture at the exhibitions, this piece was actually arranged by so many, many composers. I at least I know 10 composers. I forgot the name, so I cannot really tell you. But Ravel is the most known. Basically, what happened was that somehow, I mean, I shouldn't say somehow, this Mussorgsky's, you know, piano version had a lots of a possibility for lots of, I mean, other composers to really orchestrate. Do you know that piano is only one type of sound? Like, for example, you know, the one particular movement is called the Old Castle. So Ravel uses alt saxophone. It's incredible imagination of using this alt saxophone sound to describe this old castle. Yeah, I mean, so like a string section kind of create this really kind of mysterious mood. You cannot really do with the piano.
Now, this piece, Pictures in an Exhibition, is a suite of 10 pieces or pictures, as you brought up. It begins with a promenade, I was reading, a theme that returns 4 times. Other movements or pictures, as you've described them, have kind of strange names, like The Gnome. You brought up Old Castle. There's one called Cattle. There's one called Ballet of Unhatched Chicks.
Yeah, I don't know.
But that I listened to, and it does sound like chickens.
Yes, yeah, so that's the kind of imagination of Mussorgsky. So those paintings are not necessarily really great painting or anything, especially this particular chicken movement. It was a design for ballet. So it wasn't a real picture, but it's just a kind of a boy, you know, standing with a costume of actually egg. So then Mussorgsky, with his imagination, he made him dance, or he basically went even beyond. He saw this chicken is dancing, unhatched chicken, right? Yeah. So that was actually Mussorgsky's kind of a credit, right? Because of his amazing imagination, then he created these amazing pieces. So then that inspired other composers to orchestrate.
Thus, after Saturday, we'll come to an end the 2017-2018 season, and your thoughts will turn to an entirely new era for not only the symphony, but other entities as well. Your new home will await you. Tell me what you think it will mean to have this kind of fresh air next season.
I mean, obviously, the excitement comes to my mind first. We actually appreciate that in having the, you know, state theater. That was the reason, you know, we were able to perform. But the Pablo Center, you know, the acoustics, and I mean, it's amazing. I mean, acoustics of the hall is really crucial for the orchestra because it is an instrument. And then we can provide much better balance and color and everything. Of course, you know, we have to step up to the quality of the hall. Now we have no excuse. Oh, we wish we had a better hall we can play. No. We do have a great hall, so we have to step up to the level of the hall. But we are very excited to improve our quality of performances. And also, I hope that many community people comes to really experience how great the new hall is. I don't know yet. However, I'm a kind of a guy, I always get some vision. I'm already performing in the hall. I would say I have been performing in the hall since probably 1991, since I came here. That has been my dream. It's now coming true.
Psychologically, for the orchestra, do you think you'll see a difference? Will they have more energy? Will they smile more? Do you plan on seeing a new Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra in ways?
Yeah, I mean, they're already smiling and they're already excited about, you know, how much actually we have improved. Yeah, we are talking about that all the time now. They are just so excited. We cannot wait to really get in there to perform. Yeah, it's already around the corner, really, right there.
Do you have your first concert date set?
Our first concert is actually October 6th.
I'm sure you're planning something special.
Yeah, it's a big, big event.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Spectra West on WPR. Support for WPR comes from Chanhassen Dinner Theaters, performing Disney's new Broadway musical, Newsies, presented by Star Tribune. High energy song and dance celebration. More information available at chanhassendt.com. Support also comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony, Elgar's Enigma Variations, and Mussorgsky Ravel's Pictures and an Exhibition, featured in the season-ending concert Saturday, May 12th, UW Eau Claire's Gantner Concert Hall. Details at cvsymphony.org. I thought I'd missed a few recordings along the way. The last Greg Gilbertson recorded music I heard was instrumental, Bunch of Pickin' and Grinnin'. Turns out that was the last time he recorded a collection, and the new CD, which includes Pickin', Grinnin', Singin', and Collaboratin', felt different. And I thought I'd missed a generation or two. Not the case. This is just a new step in a natural direction.
Well, there's a gut reaction whenever these stories start to swirl. Around here seems the rumors of war come from the other side. Go that far. One thing I've come to learn.
music of Greg Gilbertson. The new CD is called Surviving the Echoes. Our recent conversation began with something unabashed that I had read. This album is an exploration of how our best ideas and intentions have bitten us in the ass. I love
it. I like it.
Now, I read your whole bio. As you can tell, I grabbed that quote from there, and I'm sure glad I saw that, because I like saying ass on the radio. So tell me about that. What do you mean, exploration? I literally use some Greg Gilbertson as transition music.
I catch it once
on
in a while.
Show.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how long has it been between recording?
10 years.
Over the span of 10 years, you decided that it was important to explore how our best ideas and intentions bite us.
Yeah, we don't think too far ahead sometimes, do we?
No.
The stuff that moves me more, I think the instrumental guitar phase, last time I talked to you, like, that was a phase I was going through, and I'm glad I did, because, like, I'm a much better player for it. A lot of Michael Hedges and Billy McLaughlin influences too. Yep.
Yes.
But, and I got some attention for it, and I guess I appreciate that, but it's always been words that move me, whether it's poetry or anything, and so to be able to write lyrics, and in the process, learn to sing a little bit, it's more fun arranging music for a band than it is just playing it on your own all the time.
And so that's a good natural transition, this discussion, because when I first listened to the CD that you were nice enough to give me, it's called Surviving the Echoes, I said to myself, man, this isn't the Greg Gilbertson that I remember.
That's kind of what I wanted you to say.
Tell me if I'm wrong, because I'm going to make some observations here. It sounded a lot more commercial to me than the last album.
Yeah, it's not like the fingerstyle guitar thing is a really niche thing.
I thought for some reason that I had missed a whole heck of a lot of Greg Gilbertson stuff in the last 10 years.
No, I've been raising kids and yeah.
Okay.
The plan is actually to follow this up with kind of, like, I've got a lot of instrumentals and they're good songs. I want to do something with them. So I think we're probably going to do an EP after this that'll kind of ride off the imagery of this record and kind of some of the same themes, but it would be, it'd be instrumental. And I think I've already got that ready to go. I think I can, at this point, almost walk into the studio and bang it out.
Okay, so I'm going to read my notes the way I wrote them. The observation that I was going to make, and I had to qualify myself by saying, I don't have all your stuff, but what I do have, I like a lot, which means I actually did have all your stuff. So then I was going to say, this feels, or at least some of it feels, a bit more commercial. As in, let's see what my stuff sounds like with a full orchestra.
Yeah.
Keys, steel, drums, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do this because you needed to get more out of what you were doing? But now you've already explained that you're a wordsmith as well as a guitar guy.
Yeah, and I like music. Like, I like arranging. I like,
you know.
Yeah, I like having, you know, the bigger arsenal you have. Doesn't mean you got to use it all, but the more you can do. So to have horns on this record, to have piano, and to have some really good players too. Like, to be surrounded with really competent players and let them kind of cut loose and do what they want was really rewarding. Because now I can listen to the CD and I'm not, like, I can enjoy it because I'm listening to my buddies play. You know, I'm not just listening to me.
So when you play in public, are you alone most of the time? Or do you do a group thing once in a while?
It depends on the thing. We just did a big group thing on Thursday night that had the whole horn section.
Kind of a CD release.
It was a CD release, yeah. Cool. And it was awesome. Billy Krause opened it up.
In the studio with Greg Gilbertson. He's got a new album, Surviving the Echoes. 7 songs out of the 10 have one-word titles. So do you start with one word and you build on that when you write a song, or what do you...
Sometimes I did, yeah. Like, one of the more important lyrical pieces on there is called Trees.
One sounds more like the Greg Gilbertson I know than any other one on the scene.
Yep. It's got that real open, spacious guitar sound. Yep. That has... my buddy called me and said, hey, you know, trees can be used for a lot of images.
Oh.
and we had a big conversation about the different... kind of metaphors for trees and different traditions, and so that song, just the rest of the day, that one kind of festered and kind of came out.
She was born in a grove of trees, halfway between two shining seas, and the things that folks said don't forget will float away where two rivers met. But she remembers how the pine trees smell, and the memories that those cedars held. Then the trees she loved were all cut down. Well, that's what happens in a logging town.
folks boast of how far you can see. She don't like this kind of free.
There's also a science, or at least a procedure or structure, for naming a CD. The title coupled with artwork is like curb appeal when selling a house. Mm-hmm. Put the whole package together. So one of the songs is titled Echoes, and the CD's called Surviving the Echoes. Is there a relationship between these two things?
Yeah. Matthew Bailey, who did he's a Milwaukee artist, he did the cover art. And haven't seen it, it's astounding. I have the full piece in my van right now. I'm returning it to him after we go here. It's 50 inches square almost. But he and I got talking about it, and a lot of the discussion with him was there's a lot of noise, and I think we're in a time right now when, and maybe it's always been this way, but where the loudest voice, the way to be right is to be loudest sometimes, we think.
And to keep saying it the same.
And to keep saying it the same over and over again, and by communicating.
Which is like an echo, yeah.
Yeah, and we create an echo chamber a lot of times, too. And sure. if you really want to get deep, we can talk about Facebook algorithms and things that stroke mm-hmm. us and feed our worldview. But, I mean, we're shouting at each other in 140-character tweets, and we're basically communicating in bumper stickers in a time that's pretty important right now.
Mm-hmm,
and I think we've lost the ability to a large degree to have, and this is nothing new, I think most people recognize this, we've lost the ability to have meaningful, articulate discussion.
I agree.
And I think the trick is, and at the end of the day, if you look at the cover art, basically what it is it's listening through the noise to maybe the more quiet, articulate, peaceful voices mm-hmm. that can't compete with the noise, that can't compete with the repetition of some of the narratives that we hear.
So the title of the CD is somewhat of a social comment.
It is. The whole
Not even somewhat, it's blatant.
Straight up, yeah.
Okay, good for you. But I saw a photograph on the little booklet inside of you looking as if you're doing something artistic.
That's Bailey. We look alike. We're both bald with beards.
Okay.
That's Matthew Bailey who made the piece.
So that's why you guys get along so well, because you look alike. You look in the mirror. You could be brothers.
Well, we're brothers in more ways than one. Like I love that dude to death, man.
Good.
He's just a good, good, good friend.
I'll have to talk to him to see if he says the same about you. I'm sure he does. You are, as I brought up earlier, a good guitar player. How often is your talent on the guitar a focus of what it is that you're thinking to do?
I still think of myself as a player first.
Okay.
Being able to sing and having the feature part of the song be the lyrics and the melodies is nice because it takes the pressure off, you know.
Okay.
Man, some of those, I'm a good player for a folk artist, but like I'd get my ass handed to me if I tried to keep up in some of those bluegrass and jazz circles.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm a good player. I mean, I'm competent. So when I'm writing, I'm always having the guitar arrangement in mind. And so I like solo gigs and I like solo performances for different reasons, as much as I like the other stuff. Cause I like being able to answer my vocal phrasing with my guitar phrasing, with the way I chord through a song and pick through a song. And so I just like that whole process. I think it's a lot more fun, but sometimes there's nothing better, especially when you got a band with you, than just strumming out a song, like just banging that out.
Then you don't have to think about the instrument itself.
If I don't screw up the lyrics in a song, it's probably live. It's probably one that I'm just strumming out.
We should probably bring up your family, because I'm sure they give you a lot of support. You are a family guy. You have three daughters. Is music in the house?
My daughter's becoming quite an accomplished bass player. She started, my oldest, she just turned 13 on Wednesday. She started a mandolin, and then she picked up saxophone. And she kind of, like a lot of us do, just explored her way through different things. And then this electric bass thing really seems to have stuck. She's a seventh grader, but she's playing with the high school jazz band and stuff.
Oh, do you play together?
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. She, yeah.
There's a really fun video on YouTube of Beth and I playing. She's playing mandolin on that one, of us playing Simple Gifts. It's a fun, cute little
That's
video.
One of the first ones you learn when you become a folk artist is Simple Gifts. You got to learn Simple Gifts.
Yep.
And, of course, that's Billy McLaughlin's...
Oh, he's got that Christmas project, thing. Doesn't he? With
he does.
Yeah, with...
See, he's the man. And you're the
that
man.
All comes back around to you, Billy. When I was learning the fingerstyle guitar thing, the way I learned was I just started tuning my guitar to different tunings, to whatever my ear,
Which
whatever
cool.
pleased my ear. Mm-hmm. And then if I wanted to learn anything, if I wanted to learn these techniques, I just had to write. I didn't, you know, I mean, there's not a lot of sheet music out for these things. Anyway, so I'd write... And, you know, when, you can, when you're kind of really woodshedding it like that and you're just learning, you know, that way, you don't really know where you're at, like how you're doing, and you really don't have any a gauge to gauge yourself against. So I scheduled a private lesson with Billy, and I scheduled like, hey, I want to start taking lessons from you.
Right.
So I drove over, and one of the milestone moments for me was he's like, yeah, Greg, guys like you and I don't need lessons. And I just left going, feeling a little embarrassed, but at the same time going like, hell yeah, man, you know?
Well, part of the reason that it's tough to woodshed like that, sometimes you do really great stuff and you don't remember it.
Yeah.
And you wish you did. I have a book scored this way. I do six lines, and if I come up with a chord or a sequence, boy, I don't go on until I put a little pencil thing in there.
There have been so many times where I'll just tune my guitar to some goofy tuning and just, let's see what's here. I guess I haven't done this in a while, but it used to be that way a lot. And I'd just start playing. I'd start this little idea, and I'm like, there's some, you know, this is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I got to play somewhere else, so my guitar's back in standard. Not only do I not remember the tune or how it sounded, I don't remember what tuning it was.
Sure.
It's thoroughly gone forever.
That's fun to do. Cool.
The only alternate tunings I really do now, unless I'm playing one of my old pieces, and I still play a lot of those, although I've forgotten even a lot of the ones I've recorded. That Limited Vocabulary record is from 07, and it's more of a high-end demo. It's not really a true record, you know, and it's just me. Those are the songs I learned as I was trying to play, and I just thought, you know, what the hell, let's just record these. But anyway, so if I'm not in standard right now, one thing I do a lot of is I got these small hands with these fat fingers, and so I'll tune my low string up a half step when I'm in like a C position, because I really like that two in the, like a major seven in the four chords. Like standard, you know, 1-3-5, four chords bore me. and so I'll do that a lot. And that way that F position, you've got your open string on top that you can play. And it just leaves for a lot more phrasing. I do a lot of drop D stuff, but between that half step up, drop D and standard, that's where I do spend pretty much
slide
all the time
it,
now.
Do you use a slide at all?
No. I started learning slide for a while, and then it started forcing me into, like, you know, open E and open D tunings and stuff. And I'm just like, I just wasn't interested enough.
They're kind of fun. I inherited an old resonator guitar that was my mother's. She got it in the 30s.
Oh, cool. What, do you know what?
And it's wood, and it actually has the brother's patent on the resonator.
Oh, does it?
Oh, yeah.
Very cool.
It could have very well been a Montgomery Ward's or a Sears.
It's not a square neck, though, is it? I mean, is it a dobro?
It's not
or
square
is
neck, no, okay, but it's got a real thick, rounded neck. I see guys like Howard Liedtke playing slide, and I go, well, you should just stop thinking about it.
Yeah. Derek Trucks, to listen to that dude play slide, his phrasing is brilliant. Yeah. I'll binge on YouTube for an unhealthy amount of time just watching Derek Trucks play.
And doesn't that make you want to do it?
Yeah, a little bit. But, you know, at this point, I'm so... Yeah, and I don't, like, when I play with the boys, I don't have a backup guitarist and stuff. And so, like, I'd have to learn to really keep everything... sometimes, you know, between when it's just bass, drums, and guitar, I'm the only harmonic instrument. And so I want to kind of keep that going, and then I don't...
Well, you don't want to just be a Greg of all trades. You want to... You want to specialize in a couple.
A little bit. I do kind of want to be a Greg of all trades on some level, but it's just, well, at some point, how much attention do you have?
That's what happens, you know, to me. But, you know, this isn't about me. Hey, congratulations on a fine compilation.
Thanks.
Where are they available? All over?
They're available at my website at greggilbertson.com. They're available locally here at the local store at Volume 1 at Revival Records. We will get vinyl pressed at some point, but
you will.
That's down the road. Yeah. Oh, cool. Well, when the artwork's that good, like, I want the biggest representation of it possible.
Oh, yeah.
But it's everywhere. Digital media is streamed and sold. iTunes, Amazon, Spotify, Apple Music, everywhere.
That compilation we're talking about is called Surviving the Echoes. Greg Gilbertson, thanks.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
When the masters of mankind dim the lights and pull the blinds, crunch the numbers and figure which war's next to wage, they'll sing the glory of the stripes of the flag. Magnetic strips are all they care that you wave, as bombs fall somewhere in this day and age. Thank you. nights I'm won't easily go down. Kid, we got foxholes all over this town. Rebels armed with neither gun nor flag.
That's a great CD, but you know what? You're going to have to go out and get it in order to listen to more. Sorry. Coming up next week on Spectrum West, a peek at the Big River Radio Wave show coming to Alma next Friday, an important play coming to the Heidi Center, and lots more. Spectrum Memo, remember, Saturday evening is the Big Spring Swing 18 featuring the Menominee High School Jazz Ensembles and Alumni Jazz Ensemble. It's at Menominee High School. Doors open 6:30, dance lessons at 7, music starts at 8. Chippewa Valley Museum opens up after hours on Friday from 7 to 10. The After Dark series is back with American Gothic at the museum celebrating rural life in the valley. You can get some information at afterdarkec.org or cvmuseum.com. The Cafe Accordion Orchestra performs Saturday evening at the Phipps in Hudson. Showtime 7:30. The theme is cinema, songs heard in films, revised to evoke the feel of a Parisian cafe. Speaking of cafe, next Thursday the 17th, you can eat in a number of area restaurants, and 25% of your bill will help support the Open Door Clinic in Chippewa Falls. Probably get a list of those restaurants at chippewaopendoor.org. That sounds pretty cool. Thanks to the Spectrum crew as always, and if you're listening Thursday, we're looking forward to seeing you at the WPR Listener Appreciation Event this afternoon and evening at Artisan Forge in Eau Claire, and if you're listening Friday, sure was good to see you. For Jim Oliver, I'm Al Ross. See you next week.